Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Lester Brown has spent his entire life researching the relationships between people, food populations, and policy, and has traveled the earth, pulling together the pieces and the players that he feels could begin to turn the tide. We continue our discussion with Janet Larson, Director of Research for the Earth Policy Institute, to begin to identify the major themes of change. We continue our discussion with Janet Larson, Director of Research for the Earth Policy Institute, to begin to identify the major themes that will change the world. By the time we finish with the problems, people are going to say, what in the world are we supposed to do? But it is important for us to understand. Global warming is obviously a huge challenge, and it particularly is a challenge because as the developing nations, China and India, Africa and South America and Asia and Indonesia develop, greenhouse gases are just going to increase, and they are, and we're facing some real challenges from global warming. So we're adding now this. We've talked briefly about the oil peak. Most people are familiar with that concept. That's why I'm not spending a lot of time on oil peak. But now global warming as well. Now we have a third layer of problem that's kind of happening all at the same time. Let's talk about global warming and what Lester is talking about.
Well, I think one thing we looked at is just what is projected in terms of global temperature rise. And you mentioned growing developing countries. Unfortunately, these poor developing countries that are going to bear the brunt of much of the effects of climate change, the worldwide body that monitors climate and reports on it, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has projected that by the end of this century, we could see a temperature rise of up to 10 degrees Fahrenheit, 2.5 to 10.4 degrees Fahrenheit this century. And where the warming is happening most rapidly is at our polar regions, and that's where we have our ice caps. One of the biggest and most frightening aspects of global warming is the potential for sea level rise. And when the Arctic ice cap melts, for instance, it doesn't raise sea level because that water, that ice is already floating. But if the ice on Greenland or the ice in Antarctica were to melt, and scientists now are reporting, you see almost every year they say, yes, Greenland's melting, and it's melting faster than we thought.
Twice and three times as fast, many are saying, yes.
And so if Greenland were to go, which that could raise sea level by 27 feet.
That's very significant. This is something that we are literally facing in the future. You know, the question is, first of all, is there something that we can do? And there certainly are. We'll talk about that. But as well, where do we get the leadership to manifest this? Another problem that we're witnessing as a human civilization on this planet, and it's a very sad one, and it's scary in many cases, and that is the decline of animal populations and diversity around the world. Another huge problem.
And it has a big, strong climate connection, too, because the animals that we know, the plants and animal life we know today, largely has thrived in the climate system we know today. So as temperatures get warmer, some species will adapt more quickly and more easily than others. One thing we're looking at is just the small effects of a rise in climate on certain bird species. And there have been a lot of studies coming out of the UK because the British people tend to love their birds. They're seeing in the spring birds are hatching several weeks earlier, but what they're not matching up to is the emergence of the caterpillars that they eat. So that's one of the connections between climate and biodiversity loss. But biologists now term the period we're in as the Earth's sixth great extinction, and the past extinctions that we're familiar with, like the loss of the dinosaurs, for instance, they were caused by factors large that could not be controlled. But the mm-hmm. sixth great extinction, of course, is largely human caused by our cutting down forests, by overfishing the seas, and turning land to farms and turning farms to cities. We've greatly changed the landscape of the Earth's surface, and at the expense of some plants and animal species.
Yes, and of course there are the stories now coming out that the oceans may be completely depleted of any adult fish species by 2040, 2050, which is another, I mean, when you think about the cultures such as China, although that will, we have some good news about that we'll talk about in terms of what China is doing to change their reliance on ocean fish to homegrown fish, is kind of interesting. But these are the kinds of challenges that are facing the world. And as well, you're finding is the forests that are being just destroyed wholesale in many areas, and they are the lungs of the world, and so there are these compounding problems. What Lester is suggesting is that there is evidence that we're literally in decline in some areas on our Earth. We are seeing a declining civilization, and he makes some interesting points about trends that are indicating that clearly.
I think one thing in the news that we're seeing more and more frequently is talk of failed and failing states. When we see Somalia come up in the news much more frequently recently because of current conflicts, and we begin to ask the question, what happens when we have a country like Somalia where central government has basically fallen apart and there's no government control? What happens to these failing states? When does a state become truly a failed state, and what does that lead to, and how many failed states can you have before you have a failed society? And it's hard to know, but if you look at, say, the case of Somalia, for instance, several years back, people were saying, well, what happens if polio moves to Somalia, where there's no government control? And if you look at the history of polio eradication, for a while it looked like polio was going to go the way of smallpox, that we would basically rid it from our society. While there was a great effort, and they got the world down to about 800 cases of polio worldwide, largely because of problems in Nigeria where the vaccinations were stopped because of political misinformation, there polio sprung back up, and indeed it was passed around during the Muslim pilgrimage, and because of that, polio was brought back into Somalia, a failed state.
Yes.
So, and that, of course, has implications far beyond the country's borders. That sort of thing affects everybody, so I think failed states are not something that we can ignore.
It's interesting. That's a really good point, because having grown up in the 50s and 60s when polio was a dominant theme in life, and I'd witness friends who were walking around with the braces on their legs because they were victims of polio, and we were warned about things. There was a concerted effort to vaccinate everybody, and it worked. You know, it was a national effort. And the point is that now, as we move into the 2007, the 21st century, those basic systems that seemed to be so possible then, that should be relatively simple and straightforward, for some reason, are now no longer possible.
Yes. That should be a success story.
Exactly, right. And as well, there are other indications of decline, which has to do with trends, one of them being life expectancies. And Lester makes a good point that in some areas, life expectancies are declining.
Looking at sub-Saharan Africa in particular, we're seeing in a number of countries where HIV/AIDS has really grabbed hold of society, life expectancies that used to be the sort of thing you could count on, life expectancy going up year after year. But in a number of sub-Saharan African countries, life expectancy now is falling, and falling in some places like Botswana and Swaziland by about 2 decades, loss of about almost 2 decades mm-hmm. of life because of HIV/AIDS.
From 60-some years to 40-some years, I don't know the exact numbers, but that's a significant decrease in life expectancy, and it's not supposed to trend that way.
AIDS has brought these countries back almost to life expectancies close to the Middle Ages. The last That's decades true. And decades of positive progress because of the inability to prevent the spread of AIDS.
Mm-hmm. And as well, another interesting benchmark for progress of society or the decline of society has to do with hunger. And one would think that with our vast technologies and the resources that we have available, that quite honestly, we should be able to deal with this problem. But in many cases, it's exactly the opposite. There are examples around the world that Lester covers.
The UN Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that about 850 million of the world's people are chronically hungry. That means 850 million people don't get enough food so that they can achieve full physical and mental development or maintain adequate levels of physical activity. These people are not able to be productive members of society. And in this day and age, it's a tragedy that we haven't been able to solve the problem. And you see the highest rates of malnutrition and malnourishment in sub-Saharan Africa, where the AIDS also comes into play. They've found that malnourished people are also more likely to contract diseases like AIDS, like malaria, and further the downward spiral.
So the strange truth that Lester Brown makes in his book Plan B is that the world is changing right now. It is truly reaching a point of accumulating different effects that are very dangerous to our society, the future of life and civilizations and our cultures. And unfortunately, there is no system. There just doesn't seem to be a plan. There doesn't seem to be the united will to address this. And if we don't, well, listeners can formulate their own conclusions about what may happen. But the truth, from my perspective, is I think a lot of people would agree that we either deal with this and or we're going to really go into an era that we've never experienced before. But that's where the real problem is, and that's which we started out this discussion, and that is Plan A, unfortunately, has no means to effectively deal with this, that society is based primarily on profitability and growth, without accounting for the real cost of, for example, the exploitation of natural resources, is a plan that cannot work because if it's just based on economics, certain people will win, but perhaps whole segments of society will lose. And that's not a viable future. It will lead to political and social instability and literally, potentially, catastrophe and suffering. So therefore, Lester Brown has spent his years traveling around the world talking with people, doing terrific amounts of research, very in-depth research, and it's obvious, Janet, talking from you, that you really do have an extraordinary breadth and depth of knowledge about the very specific details, and it's very refreshing to hear that. I guess another aspect that we need to talk about, which he certainly covers in the book, and that is the fact that, unfortunately, our Plan A economy does not take into effect the real cost, the real value of our resources. The first order of business is we have to start to realize what the real cost of, for example, a gallon of gasoline might be.
One thing we talk about is the need to build an eco-economy. That's an economy that understands the world's natural limitations, because while a lot of people would argue that it's the economy that provides growth and moves us into the future, the economy, of course, is supported by an underlying environmental system, and the economy needs to respect that. Unfortunately, the global economic market does have some major weaknesses in that it does not incorporate into prices the indirect costs of these prices. Say, the example you gave, burning a gallon of gasoline. You can drive up to a gas pump and pay $2 or $3 per gallon for your gasoline and drive away happy, but what's coming out of your tailpipe does more than $2 or $3 worth of damage in terms of causing air pollution that raises incidences of respiratory ailments, raises incidences of asthma, the greenhouse gas emissions coming out of your tailpipe that are raising temperatures around the world. These are things that you're not paying when you're paying, nor are you paying at the pump the cost of expensive wars in vulnerable areas to defend our oil supply. you're not paying these costs, but somebody is, society is. One group that did an analysis trying to calculate what are exactly the indirect costs of gasoline, and they included oil industry tax breaks and oil industry subsidies and the healthcare costs of treating all these auto exhaust-related respiratory illnesses. And they found that these indirect costs are closer to about $9 per gallon, whereas
That's right.
We're only paying, you know, $2 or $3 per gallon of gasoline, nowhere near the actual true cost.
And that relates directly to this concept of the real cost of the modern age, and that unless we factor those in, there's actually an unwritten subsidy to the oil industry, for example, or oil users, that encourages continued use of these resources because there is no real, we're not really paying the real price. Lester suggests a number of rather interesting ways to start to restructure this concept, and I find them so interesting. In reading the book, all of a sudden, as I got into really how this is done, I said, this is so simple. In many respects, obviously, this is very difficult, but the concept actually is very, very interesting. And he starts out by really addressing the concept of changing the tax structure. He calls it tax shifting, and that's a really powerful, easy concept to comprehend. Let's talk about tax shifting, because that's where this begins to really have substance.
Well, tax shifting, or in some countries it's called environmental tax restructuring, is basically simple. It means raise taxes on ecologically destructive activities. But, and before everybody gets all up in arms and says, you can't raise taxes, you raise these taxes on these things that are bad to society, while meanwhile lowering taxes on things that are good for society, namely income.
Yeah.
So you're raising taxes on environmentally destructive activities, and you're lowering income taxes. And that will allow the market to function much more purely by having true prices and to reflect the environmental harm, say, in burning that gallon of gasoline or digging for coal. That sort of thing.
And what's interesting is it's tax shifting. The economy kind of stays the same. It's just that now, when you talk about that, there's this big smile on my face because I said, now this makes sense. I know in the past, when people would talk about, for example, putting a $2.50 tax on gasoline, certainly there's millions of people who said, you can't do that. I can't afford it. But the whole concept that Lester Brown is talking about is, no, you decrease taxes on income, because that's good work. That has real value in society. But you shift the taxes to those areas where there is an added cost. Therefore, we have more money to spend and to enjoy life, and it may cost us more in some arenas, but it's a tax shifting. So in reality, we kind of stay the same, but we're taxing the right entities. And in that process, they become more costly, and it's a market economy.
Exactly, and the cleaner companies, the cleaner industries, they will prosper and do well. But to the consumer, it basically ends up it being about even.
One example of that I thought was so interesting, for example, in forests, one of the things that people need to understand is that trees are actually performing services to our society. They clean the air. They protect the topsoil. They provide recreational opportunities. They literally provide services that if they weren't there, some other mechanism or system, we'd have to pay money to clean our air or to restore our soils. The concept of what he called a stumpage tax is so fascinating in the sense that if you cut down a tree, you also have to pay a stumpage tax because society's going to have to pay extra to perform the services of that tree. That's a real basic concept, and it can be applied out to many, many different areas.
And that's one that we've realized in some areas, like when New York City, for instance, was debating over whether they spend, I think it was $9 billion to improve their water treatment system to provide water for the city. They could do that, or they could pay something like $1 billion to protect the watershed in the Catskill Forest area, make sure those forests were standing, because forests that are standing can stabilize soil. They're natural purification systems for the water. So the city actually did look at what the costs would compare it by allowing nature to do its job, and they opted for that, saving the city and taxpayers billions of dollars by truly valuing ecosystem services.
Another example, because some of these things get to be very difficult to understand. I'm not an economist, and I wish I had more of an economist's head. I get confused by some of these concepts. So it's always refreshing to find examples where someone has really explained this well. Another concept is this is a tradable permits, permitting, and in the case of fishing and lobster fishing, there's a great example. In a specific area, they realized that lobsters are being overfished, and but in a free market economy, how in the world do you keep people from fishing? So what happened was they applied a, they said there's so many lobsters available that will allow to be taken, and then they handed out permits, sold permits at a certain fee, but then those permits were able to be sold up the line to the highest bidder. It achieved a true market value based on what the lobster companies were willing to pay to harvest so many lobsters. That's just a brilliantly simple concept that creates that value without regulation. It's a free market regulation. It's really brilliant.
And we've also done that in this country with sulfur dioxide emissions. When we were very worried about acid rain, which is caused by sulfur dioxide coming out of power plant smokestacks, and they again issued tradable permits for emissions by attaching a price to pollution. They were able to award the most efficient and the cleanest power plants, and it worked to lower overall sulfur dioxide emissions.
Subsidies. We subsidize a lot of companies, oil companies, electric companies, big consumers of electricity, et cetera, et cetera. It ends up that we pay for those subsidies because, they're, again, these companies are able to sell their products at a reduced rate. We certainly appreciate that. However, it's the added cost that's not being factored in. So one of the aspects that Lester also talks about is shifting subsidies.
One of my favorite quotations in the book is from an Earth Council study, where by realizing that the world's taxpayers provide about $700 billion of subsidies for environmentally destructive activities, and this report said, well, there's something unbelievable about the world spending hundreds of billions of dollars annually to subsidize its own destruction. We looked at a variety of subsidies, everything from oil extraction or drilling or coal-fired power plants. Some of the countries with the most egregious subsidies are our biggest oil producers. For instance, in Iran, the price for oil is about one-tenth of the world price. And if you've ever been into Iran, you'll see the cities are choked with cars and suffering from pollution because this lower oil prices largely encourages car ownership and gas consumption.
That's like a reverse feedback loop. It by subsidizing, you encourage your own destruction.
Exactly.
Which is exactly what we don't need to do. Now we're beginning to define Plan B. We're starting to talk about some of the strategies that as listeners listen to some of these things, begin to imagine these things, to start to visualize them as part of a way of life and how we can, without radically changing anything, make a difference. Another concept is eco-labeling, and of course we're familiar with that, but there's some great examples. I know, for example, I've talked with people at FSC, the Forest Stewardship Council, where you have an opportunity to buy right, to buy ecologically appropriate materials by looking for a label. It's just so simple. For example, if you go to Home Depot and you're going to buy wood, some of the wood will have an FSC label. Home Depot has committed to buying FSC, which means that those products are coming from sustainable forests, and therefore we can make a difference. We can choose. That also is a terrifically powerful area where we can make a difference. There's also the new materials economy and new industries. This is where it starts to get exciting, because as we start to really realize that we can make a difference, that as a matter of fact, we must make a difference, and we're seeing it already in terms of solar and wind and other things, let's talk about some of the terrific opportunities economically and in terms of jobs and whole new industries that can transform the society economically and also from the perspective of sustainability.
I think what's really exciting about Plan B is that you can see bits and pieces of Plan B actions in place around the world. And on the energy front, you can look toward Denmark, which has made great strides into moving a lot of their electricity use to wind power. In Japan, you look at their solar rooftops and their great development of solar cells, and that's another important piece of the renewable energy economy, moving away from these fossil fuels and toward renewable green sources of energy. And both those technologies, solar power and wind power, were basically pioneered in the United States. With wind, it was the early 1980s in California where the modern wind industry was born on those California hillsides. And with the solar cell, the modern photovoltaic zone was developed in Bell Labs in New Jersey. And these were great innovations, but unfortunately the United States dropped the ball. And now you look at Japan for solar, or you look toward Europe, Germany, and Denmark for wind. So I think these are examples of how investing in a technology can really provide economic growth. And I think it's a big challenge for the United States to go back and resume our place as a leader in renewable energy and realize that jobs are on the line for automobile technology. For instance, many people who are concerned about gas mileage because of the higher prices they're paying at the pump, that they look at their car choices and they may very well buy a Japanese vehicle, even though they want to buy an American vehicle, just because the Japanese vehicles have moved much further ahead in terms of fuel economy standards.
We continue our discussion with Janet Larson, Director of Research for the Earth Policy Institute, to begin to identify the major themes that will change the world. Stay tuned.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.